So we'll continue on this evening. We'll start from verse 7. And actually, there's different translations of these verses, so according to the translator. Okay, so this one reads, "From now on, divorce from well-being, this helpless wanderer, this self-grasping who is the emissary of demons, which seeks its own selfish happiness and prosperity, joyfully embrace hardships for the sake of others." Okay, so we are helpless wanderers, or transmigrators going from one body to the next body, beginninglessly in cyclic existence, under the control of our afflictions and karma. And this verse specifically mentions the self-grasping that is the emissary of demons. So the self-grasping refers to the self-grasping ignorance. That's the mind that grasps at the inherent existence of ourself and all other phenomena. And that self-grasping ignorance is the root of samsara. That's what has to be eliminated to attain liberation. And that's the emissary, or it heralds, it brings forth the demon of the self-centered mind. So these two are companions in evil, so to speak. The self-grasping ignorance is like the dictator, okay? And it sets the policy, which is that I and everything else is inherently existent. So it, you know, sets it up. And the self-centered thought is the attendant, and it carries out the policy set by the dictator. So based on this thought of this, you know, concrete self, that's really there, a real me that's really there, you know, real body and mind that are really there, then the self-centered thought arises, grasping at the happiness and importance of the self as being more worthwhile, more worthy of attention than anybody or anything else. Okay, so we have this solid knot of our own self-grasping, and then we just spin around it, you know, again and again and again, so that, you know, every thought we have is always about how can I benefit, how can I be happy, how can I get what I want, you know, day and night this happens. And it's not that we're bad people for thinking like this, you know, we shouldn't get confused and blame ourselves, blame the conventional I, but rather see that the real enemy, you know, is twofold, the self-grasping ignorance and the self-centered thought, and to blame them, okay? So we shouldn't feel guilty for being selfish, because that is just more self-centeredness, yeah? But instead, see that whole mechanism of self-centeredness, which includes the guilt, as our enemy and something that we're going to oppose. Okay, so it's that self-centered thought that seeks its own selfish happiness and prosperity. Okay, so we're just thinking, how can I be happy? How can I be prosperous? How can everything go well for me? And because of that thought, we wind up miserable. And it's easy to see when we examine our own experience that the more self-centered we are, the more self-absorbed we are, the more sensitive we are to everything that happens to us. And the more sensitive we are, the unhappier we are. Okay? So when we're really self-sensitive, you know, somebody doesn't smile at us, and we're instantly, oh no, what did I do? Uh-oh. I blew it, you know. Or instead of blaming ourselves, we blame the other one. Oh, they didn't smile at me. Who do they think they are for acting that way around me? And it's just all the self-centeredness, you know, interpreting everything so that it's always spinning and revolving around the self. So we can see so clearly, you know, when we look at our own experience, how the self-centeredness makes us miserable right now, you know. And so even though we think that being self-preoccupied is good, you know, because we think I got to take care of myself, because if I don't take care of myself, who will? We don't know how to take care of ourselves properly, and so we make ourselves more miserable. So this whole issue of taking care of ourselves, I think, is an important one, because there's a correct way to do it and an incorrect way to do it. Okay? We have a body and mind. They're the basis of attaining all spiritual realizations, so we have to care for them. So we keep our body healthy, we keep it clean, we eat well, we get exercise, we sleep, you know. But we do it as a way of keeping the tool for our liberation working properly. We keep our body working properly. And we do that with the motivation to be able to practice and gain the realization so that we can benefit others. You know, so that way of taking care of our physical and mental needs, that's fine, you know, that's great. That's not self-centered. We have to take care of ourselves in that way. But often when we say, I've got to take care of myself, or if I don't care for myself, who will? We're going to the extreme of the negative way of taking care of ourselves, which is the self, you know, complete self-absorption of, you know, oh, my little toe hurts, you know, this is very serious, or somebody didn't smile at me, or somebody used this tone of voice, you know, with me, or I didn't get the promotion, or, you know, whatever it is. But interpreting everything that happens in this vast universe as an insult or as offensive to the I. So that is the wrong way of taking care of ourselves. Because when we do that, you know, we become hypersensitive. And then we run around trying to control the world, control the environment, control sentient beings, make everybody do and be what we want them to do and be, so that we can be happy. And in the process of that, you know, we hurt a lot of other people's feelings, we offend them, we create a lot of negative karma that then ripens on ourselves. So that's the wrong way to take care of ourselves, because that harms us. Okay. So as an antidote to the wrong way of taking care of ourselves, Dharma Rakshita advises joyfully embrace hardships for the sake of others. Okay. In other words, turn our attention to the welfare of others. And if we have to experience some hardship to be able to benefit them, then that's worthwhile. Okay. Because if we look in all of our previous existences in samsara, we've had plenty of hardship. I mean, we've been born in the hell realm and the animal realm and the hungry ghost realm limitless times. We've endured so much hardship. We've been drafted in the army. We've been, you know, as human beings, we've spent time in prison. We've had all sorts of horrible things happen to us in cyclic existence, going through all sorts of hardship. But there's been no meaning or no worth to it. Because we've been going through the hardship, our mind's always been thinking, I don't like this, the world should be different, how can I be better, you know, get all these horrible people out of my way so I can be happy. And by that way of thinking, creating more cause of suffering. On the other hand, when we undergo hardship with the motivation to attain spiritual realizations, then the hardship becomes worthwhile. Okay? So if we, you know, have to stay up a little late to finish our prayer commitments and we're tired, we do that. Or if we're doing retreat and, you know, sometimes our back and knees hurt, we're willing to do that. or if in the course of learning the Dharma we have to travel long ways and be very uncomfortable traveling or sit in uncomfortable places to learn the Dharma, that kind of hardship is worthwhile. Yeah. So because we're bearing the hardship for the purpose of liberation and for the purpose of being able ultimately to be of the greatest benefit to others. Okay. So it's not that hardship and suffering are valuable in and of themselves. You know, we shouldn't think, oh, the more I suffer, the holier I am. Okay? Because it's not the suffering that is valuable. It's our attitude towards the suffering. It's our attitude towards the hardship. So we shouldn't try and inflict hardship and suffering on ourselves. You know, it comes automatically. We don't need to go looking for it. But when it comes, instead of running away from it, you know, with a self-centered attitude, to transform it and use it on the path. Okay? And so in that way, we counteract the self-grasping ignorance and the self-centered thought, and we're able to stop ourselves from being a helpless wanderer in cyclic existence. Okay, then verse 8. Propelled by karma and habituated to afflictions, the sufferings of all beings who share this same nature, I shall heap them upon the self that yearns for its own prosperity. Okay, so we're very, very well habituated with our afflictions, you know. Attachment is our best friend. Anger is a good buddy. You know, ignorance is the companion that never leaves us. We're very well habituated to the fact that we don't even often realize when they're in our mind. And so we are thereby creating karma, and we're propelled by our karma. So our karma propels us at the moment of death, you know, fostered by the afflictions, the craving and grasping. Our karma ripens, and that propels us into the next life in cyclic existence. Similarly, once we're reborn, we have karma that ripens during our life. You know, karma that determines whether we have a healthy body or a sick body. Karma that influences if we're born in a war-torn place or a peaceful place. Karma that influences whether other people like us or not, whether we're respected or not. So there's all sorts of karma that's ripening then. And it propels us, you know. So by the time it's ripening, we don't have any choice in the matter. The point where we had the choice was when we were creating the karma, you know, doing the actions to start with. But at that time, we didn't take the choice because we were so overwhelmed by the afflictive emotions. Okay? You're getting what I'm saying? So, if we don't take the choice when we have it, then the karma is created, and unless we purify the karma, it's going to ripen. Okay? And so, to look at this situation, to meditate on it in terms of ourself and recognize that this is our situation, and generate a very strong aspiration to free ourselves from it, and then look at other beings and recognize that this is their situation as well. You know, little Manjushri the kitty here is propelled by his afflictions and karma, so he can't sit still and listen to the teachings. He's only thinking about getting fed. Okay, but you can see how, you know, the thought, his mind is just propelled by that karmic vision of the food, and the attachment is coming up. And that's exactly like we are in so many situations. So when we look at other beings, instead of looking at them with critical eyes, to recognize how overwhelmed they are by their afflictions, how propelled they are by their karma without choice, and thus that's why they do the things that we find objectionable, or that's why they are the way they are. So I find it very helpful myself in cultivating patience for people to really think, you know, that this is their situation. It's not that somebody chose, you know, oh, I think I'm going to be reborn as an obnoxious person. You know, nobody would choose that if they had the choice, but just propelled by their karma. And also I find it helpful when looking at living beings to see them as karmic bubbles, you know, instead of seeing them as some solid, you know, inherently existent person who always has been that person and always will be. It's just, you know, their body is the result of all these different causes. Their mind is the result of all these different causes. How they're the person that they're appearing to be in life is just something that's conditioned, that's the result of so many different causes. And they aren't going to be like that forever. They're not going to have that body for very long. They're not going to have that mental state for very long. They're not going to have, you know, the aggregates of that realm for very long. So whatever I'm perceiving, you know, is just a karmic bubble. They're produced by their karma. My vision of them, you know, the way I'm interpreting them is produced by my karma. And so it's not like there's, you know, solid things out there that I have to fight with and react to. And that also gives the space to have some compassion for these beings. Yeah. And so last week when I was, no, a few days ago when I was in Portland, somebody at the end of the talk, I was talking on how to be peaceful in a chaotic world, and somebody said that they have incredible trouble dealing with the present government, you know, and their anger towards the powers that be and the president. And so I started talking about, you know, looking at George Bush as a baby, you know, thinking of him as an infant being born into the family he was being born into, and how he didn't have much choice, and then he got conditioned the way he got conditioned. Or Osama bin Laden, you know, or Saddam Hussein, born into the situations they were born into, conditioned by the environment around them, conditioned by their previous tendencies and their karma. And then, you know, they start thinking of the way they think, and their thoughts propel their actions. And, you know, it's not like they're evil beings who have the intention to harm. They're just this accumulation of all this conditioning and causes, and are totally out of control themselves and under the control of afflictions and karma. And so when we see people like that, then we can have compassion for them. Yeah, I mean, a child is not choosing to run back and forth like a wild kitty. It's just propelled by the karma, you know, so he does that. Okay, so when it says here, I shall, referring to the sufferings of all beings who share the same nature, it says, I shall heap them upon the self that yearns for its own prosperity. What this means is, the self-centered thought that is just thinking about its own well-being, we're going to blame it for all of our suffering and then take the suffering of others and heap it upon our own self-centered thought. Okay? So it's very important to understand how to meditate on this correctly. Like I said before, we're not blaming ourselves for being selfish. Okay? We have to separate out the conventional self, you know, which exists by being merely labeled independence on the body and mind. We have to separate that out from the self-centered thought. They aren't the same thing. Okay? It's the difference between saying, I'm walking, and I'm walking. Okay? You know, how you view the I. Yeah? So we have to see that there's the conventional self that wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. And that conventional self deserves happiness. That, 'cause, and that conventional self is what revolves in cyclic existence, what practices the path, and what will attain enlightenment. Okay, so that conventional self, which cannot be found upon ultimate analysis, which exists only as a label given in dependence on the body and mind, that conventional self, you know, exists now and continues to enlightenment, but you can't find it when you try and find it. Okay? The inherently existent self that our ignorance grasps at, that doesn't exist at all. And the self-centered thought, you know, the ignorance that grasps at that self is not who we are. It's that, you know, it's not the I, and the self-centered thought that comes from all of, you know, all of that also is not us. Okay, so we separate out the conventional I from, you know, the inherently existent I that we think exists, and from the self-centered thought that's, you know, that is revolved with that inherently existent I. And we pinpoint the self-centered thought and give it all of the problems. And we give all of our problems to the self-grasping ignorance. Okay? So it's not that we're wishing, it's not a masochistic thing where we're trying to wish ourselves to suffer. Okay? So it's a delicate thing in our meditation, because especially as Westerners, it's extremely difficult for us to tell the difference. I mean, it's hard for anybody to tell the difference between the conventional I and, you know, the self-centered thought. But it's even more difficult for us as Westerners because we are so habituated to feel guilty for being selfish. Yeah? We've been taught this, you know, for such a long time that whenever we think of the defects of the self-centered thought, instead of thinking of it as a thought, you know, whispering in our ear and deceiving it, we think of it as who I really am. Okay? And so when we say the self-centered thought is evil, we misconstrue it and say, I'm evil. You know, therefore I'm guilty, therefore I'm defective, therefore I'm unlovable, therefore I'm hopeless, therefore why try and practice the path? Because it's not going to do any good. Okay? So that's why it's really important to separate these things out. Okay? Is that clear? Getting that? It's really very important. And it's easy for us to get confused around this issue. I remember some years ago I was talking with a very old Dharma friend, and she was telling me how when she went to see one Geshe, she had a question about the self-centered thought. And she asked the question through an interpreter. And she asked, you know, if something to the effect of, if I'm so selfish, then I should really blame myself and hate myself for being selfish, shouldn't I? And the Geshe said, yes. And then she started practicing just hating herself and blaming herself until sometime later, I think, when either she figured out she was, you know, that wasn't the case, or I think she wound up talking to another practitioner who explained, no, you know, don't mix up the conventional self and the self-centered thought. But see, the Geshe gave the answer that he did because he didn't recognize the cultural way that our Western mind thinks and how we have so much tendency to blame ourselves and hate ourselves. It seems to be something that Asians don't feel in exactly the same way that we feel because their cultural conditioning is different. Then verse 9, when the craving of self-interest enters my heart, I shall expel it and offer my happiness to all beings instead. If those around me rise in rebellion against me, I shall relish with the thought this is due to my own negligence. Okay? So when the craving of self-interest enters my heart, I shall expel it and offer my happiness to all beings instead. Okay, so we expel the craving of self-interest, yeah, by thinking of its defects and by taking on the suffering of others, and then we offer all beings our happiness in place of just thinking about our own happiness. And so this is leading us into the meditation called Tonglen, or taking and giving. So this meditation is something that we do with, you know, so many of the upcoming verses here. So the way we meditate is by seeing others who are suffering in front of us, visualizing them in front of us, cultivating great compassion for their suffering and wanting to remove them from it, and then imagining that their suffering leaves them as a form of pollution, and we take it into ourselves, and we can even inhale, thinking we're taking on this pollution, which is the suffering and the causes of suffering, the afflictions and karma of others, onto ourselves. Now, we don't just take the suffering of others and, you know, onto ourselves and sit there and suffer and go, ah, you know, hang myself on the cross, look how much I'm suffering, okay? But instead, what we do is we imagine our own self-grasping ignorance and our own self-centered thought as this lump at our heart, because that's the way we feel when they're active, like we have this tight, hard knot at our heart. So we imagine the suffering of others coming out as pollution. We inhale it. It becomes like a lightning bolt or a thunderbolt, and it slams into that lump of our self-centered thought and self-grasping ignorance and completely blows it up. Okay? Dispels it, blows it up. So, if you have the tendency to visualize violence, this is how you use it in the Dharma path, okay? It just completely smashes it to smithereens. And then, in your heart, there's just total empty space. And you stay in that empty space, and you can meditate on emptiness, the lack of, you know, a self-sufficient self, a lack of an inherently existent self. And you experience that emptiness, that freedom. And then when the mind starts to move again, you imagine light in that space at your heart. And that light radiates out. And the light you imagine is your own happiness, which you give to others. And at that point, you can imagine your body transforming into a wish-fulfilling body. In other words, it becomes whatever anybody else needs or whoever anybody else needs. So you instead of treasuring our body, oh, this dear thing, I love it, I can't stand for it to feel too hot or too cold or to suffer in any way, we, you know, transform it and multiply it and send it out so that it becomes a benefit to others. You know, so people who need a doctor, our body becomes a doctor. People who need a washing machine, it becomes a washing machine. You just give your body transforms into what other people need. Then second, we do that with our possessions. So again, we tend to hold on to our possessions. You know, my chocolate, my tape recorder, my car, my this, my that. And instead of holding on, you know, we imagine taking our possessions, multiplying them and transforming them into what others need and sending it out. And we imagine that others receive these things and thereby are happy and satisfied. And then lastly, we imagine giving even our own merit, our own positive potential or positive energy to others. Imagining it multiplying and transforming into especially what other people need to be able to practice the Dharma. So it becomes Dharma centers and monasteries and teachers and Dharma books and Dharma friends and, you know, meditation cushions or whatever anybody else needs. And we can even imagine our positive potential becomes the realizations of the path. And we give all the realization of, you know, precious human life and death and impermanence and refuge and karma and, you know, all the realizations of the long room, we send those out and imagine other people receive them, and then they are transformed and they become fully enlightened Buddhists, and we witness them being joyful and at peace, and then we feel happy that we were able to bring that about. And that happiness of being able to benefit others completely overrides any kind of discomfort that we may feel about giving our body and possessions and positive potential to others. Okay? And so this meditation, it's very good for, I think, when we experience fear, you know, fear of our own suffering, or when we're suffering ourselves and we're disliking it. So when that black lump in our own heart is growing bigger because of the self-centeredness, so we do the meditation and we really take what others don't want, their suffering and its causes, and we use it to destroy what we don't want, you know, our self-grasping ignorance and self-centered thought. Yeah, and we use that to destroy that, and then we just give, you know, and that giving frees us from the suffering of miserliness, because when we're holding on to things so tightly, we're not happy, you know, we're miserable when we're being miserly, because we're holding on to it. It's like, you know, I gotta hold on to it because I don't want to give it to somebody else, and so the mind is so tight and so miserable. And we can often relate, okay, you know, I don't want to share my body because my body's me, and I don't want to share my possessions because my possessions are, you know, they're going to make me happy. But sometimes for us, we don't really believe in good karma, so okay, share my positive potential, that's no sweat off my back, because I don't really believe in karma, okay. But I remember when I first went to Singapore, because the people in Singapore, you know, they grew up believing in karma, and they really believe in it. And I remember one man wanted me to teach him how to meditate, and I did. And then at the end, you know, the last step is to dedicate the positive potential. And so I said, take all of your positive potential and send it into the universe and dedicate it for the well-being of all others. And he looked at me and he said, I mean, and he was really, there was angst, you know. He said, I have so little positive potential, I really don't want to give it away. You know? And on one hand, I was touched that he believed in karma so much, you know? And on the other hand, I had to reassure him that positive potential isn't something that if you give it away, you won't experience the result of it, you know? But that giving it away actually multiplies it and enhances it and creates more. So when I explained that, then he relaxed a little bit. And began to think about dedicating his positive potential. Okay, then the last two lines of verse 9, if those around me rise in rebellion against me, so that can refer to our dear friends, or our students, our family, people we've benefited, people we trust, okay, people who are working for us, or people who are our employers or our colleagues, but they just rise up against us in one way or another. And it could be, you know, that they gossip behind our back. It could be that they, you know, sit and tell bad stories about us. It could be that they plot to, you know, make us look like a jerk. You know, who knows what it is, okay? But when that situation happens, you know, instead of our usual reaction of feeling hurt and angry and wanting to retaliate or wanting to go sulk, instead of that, to relish that opportunity with the thought that this is due to my own negligence, okay? So the negligence here is that we haven't opposed our self-centered thought and our self-grasping ignorance, okay? And thus, in the past, we created negative karma, you know, against others, harming others, and so now it's ripening in the people that we love and trust not wanting to be around us or harming us or, you know, being unappreciative or whatever it is. Okay? And so when this kind of situation happens, and happen it will, you know? I mean, whenever we experience it, we always feel like I'm the only one this has ever happened to. But in actual fact, you know, if you just talk to me, everybody's had that happen. You know, where the people you trust betray your trust. You know, or people that you really care about do awful things. It's like a common occurrence in samsara. So instead of just, you know, getting sunk into depression or violent with anger and plotting our revenge, just to sit there and say, ah, why is this coming to me? Because I created the cause. How did I create the cause? Under the influence of my own ignorance, anger, and attachment, and self-centeredness in previous lives, you know, or earlier this life. So if I created that kind of energy, this is the wheel of sharp weapons. This is the boomerang coming right back to me because of my own negligence and my own self-centeredness. Okay? And, you know, sometimes things can happen very quickly where we are made aware of how we ourselves created the cause for our own suffering. And sometimes there's a big gap between the cause and the effect. There was one situation that happened to me in sixth grade, which I've always remembered. You know how sixth grade girls, we've all been one, have these little cliques, you know, and you have your cliques, and, you know, you cherish everybody in your clique, and you don't like people in other cliques, and you hang on to your clique, because they're your friends, and you're dreadfully afraid of not being in a clique, because then you're really out of it. Okay, and in sixth grade, I don't know if anybody else did this, but in our classroom, we used to make lists every week, ranking the people we liked and the people we didn't like, you know, and then we would share our list on Friday afternoon, can I see your list, can I see your list, to see where we ranked with other people, you know, mm-hmm. And so everybody in our little clique was together in other people's clique. So I was in a clique with five other girls, and Rosie Knox was one of the girls in the clique. And for some reason, you know, I didn't feel that close to Rosie Knox, and I thought, let's kick her out of the clique. So I convinced the other girls, yes, we're going to kick Rosie Knox out of the clique. So we kicked her out of the clique. Rosie Knox was devastated. And at the end of the week, the other girls kicked me out of the clique. And I was devastated. And when I went to my best friend, who was still part of the clique, and said, why did you do that to me? She said, because you were really mean in what you made us do to Rosie, and we wanted you to experience what Rosie experienced. Yeah, that's what I said. Wow. You know, it was a big wake-up thing, you know. It's one of the major things I learned from sixth grade. I can't tell you much else, but I learned that. Yeah? And, that was really, you know, the boomerang came right back by the end of the week. Yeah? And, you know, so we can see that sometimes, like especially in situations with other people, when we start playing politics, but of course we never consider what we're doing politics, okay, but it actually is. When we start doing politics and getting people on our side and manipulating this and that and the other, you know, why are we so surprised when it comes right back on our own head? Yeah? I mean, we're even teaching other people how to do that, so of course it comes back on our own head. You know, it's like a parent who teaches their children to lie, and then the children lie to the parents. The parents, you know, they're the ones who showed that behavior to their children, and even sometimes had them do it to cover things up, you know, cover up the parents' mistakes. But then, you know, then the kids lie to them, and the parents are going, ah. Yeah, so it's the same thing with us. When we act harmfully, it comes right back. So when that happens, instead of, you know, being being, rebellious back, or getting angry back, or sitting there and nursing our wounds and sulking and feeling hurt and saying, I benefited all the people so much and they're so ungrateful for everything good I do to them. How can they be like that? Poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me. And we take out our mala and do 108 poor me's. Okay? It's interesting. In the text, they usually speak about being angry in relationship to stuff. But I've noticed not everybody is immediately angry. Some of us really relish poor me, For some people, it's not the anger. It's the true satisfaction of knowing you exist because you're a victim that nobody appreciates. Yeah. And our ego can get such mileage out of poor me. Why waste so much energy getting angry? I mean, adrenaline takes some energy. Why waste that when you can sit there and feel so sorry for yourself? And just really get into it. How ungrateful these people are, and I've done so much. And actually, all it is that whatever help we gave was polluted by our own expectations of receiving something good in return. So because our motivation was, there was some pollution which we didn't recognize at the moment, then when people are ungrateful, as they often will be, then we feel like, oh, poor me, nobody else has ever been treated like this before. And then we mope and we do our single pointed concentration on poor me, which we never get distracted from. We never get distracted from that one. We can sit and meditate and concentrate on poor me hour after hour, year after year. So there's the poor me people and then there's the angry people. Okay. But either way, both are coming out of incredible self-centeredness. Yeah, they both have the same root. So that's why thinking that, the root is my own self-centeredness, it's my own negligence that's causing this, then we imagine taking on the suffering of others, using it to smash our own self-centeredness and giving them our happiness. And in this particular instance, we can think of the suffering of all other people who similarly feel unappreciated and who have other people acting rebelliously towards them, and think of all these other people who face that experience and what they're going through and what they're experiencing, and take all their suffering upon ourselves. And then give them our happiness through sharing our body, positive potential, and possessions. Okay, then verse 10, and this is the one that, turned my mind to the Dharma. When my body falls prey to unbearable ailments, it is the wheel of evil karma returning on me for causing injuries to the bodies of other beings. From now on, I shall take all sickness upon myself. Okay? So in all these upcoming verses, they all follow a very similar structure of saying, when such and such unfortunate circumstance happens, it's the wheel of my own evil karma returning upon me, okay, for the wrongs that I've done. So therefore, now I'm going to develop a different habit, make a different determination, and take on, not to act that way and to act in a different way, and to take on the suffering of others, into my heart and give them my own happiness. Okay? And so it's very helpful with these upcoming verses to meditate, each verse, to meditate on the taking and giving meditation, and also to use each verse as a way to gain and develop, increase our faith in karma and the effects of karma. Okay? So because these verses are pinpointing specific instances that we come across in our life and talking about the actions that we did that created the karmic cause for them. So it's very, very practical. And if we really meditate on it, we can develop profound faith in karma. And the more we have conviction in cause and effect, in karma and its results, then the more we will be motivated to refrain from negative mental states and negative speech and deeds, and to create positive ones. So it's very practical, and it can really, if we think deeply about this, bring about some very important changes in our behavior and in our personality as we begin to break old habits and build new ones. Okay? So when my body falls prey to unbearable ailments like hepatitis, okay, or AIDS or cancer, or a stubbed toe, or a stomach ache, or a headache, or heartburn, or, you know, ulcers, or whatever ails your body at any particular time. You know, if your kidneys hurt, or you burn your tongue, or, you know, from big ailments to small ailments. Okay, to recognize that this is the wheel of our own evil karma. In other words, our own, you know, when it's used the word evil, don't think of the devil. It just means our own negative actions, our own negative karma. Okay, it's called evil because it inflicts suffering, you know, because it was motivated by a self-centered intention. So whatever I'm experiencing here, it's just, you know, the wheel coming right back on me, the boomerang coming right back on me for what I have done. And what have I done in this instance? I've injured the bodies of others. Now we might think, who, me, injured the body of others? I'm just such a sweet, nice, lovable person. You know, now we may not have killed another human being, okay, but I remember being a kid and thinking that I was doing this great deed by stacking up all the snails in the garden and stepping on them and squishing them so that they wouldn't eat the plants in the garden. Okay? And I remember with glee swatting flies, you know, thinking, oh, I'm stopping disease, swat the flies. Okay? No, we've inflicted harm on the bodies of others. Or, you know, you might have had a brother or sister that you slapped, or, you know, might have gotten in fights with other kids on the playground and thrown sand at their eyes, or kicked them in the belly, or pulled their hair, or, you know, whatever. So we've done things this life, but then think of what we could have done in a previous life. Okay? Think about maybe in a previous life, you were born as, you know, leader of a country, and you instigated a war. And as the person who instigated the war and commanded people, other people to go out and kill, you accumulated the karma of killing of all of those other people. You know, so even though you didn't do it directly because you're the one who told them to go out and do it, you get the karma of killing. So, you know, we could have very well been born in that kind of situation in the past and accumulated that kind of karma. Yeah? I mean, we've had infinite beginningless lifetimes. We have no idea what we've been reborn as. They say that we've been reborn as everything and we've done everything. So, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, you know? And yet we don't remember the actions, but, you know, the imprint of all those different actions are on our mental continuum. And when that karma ripens, when the cooperative circumstances are there and that karma ripens, boy, that suffering comes like that. Okay? So, you know, in the case of my hepatitis, the cooperative conditions were the unclean vegetables. But the principal cause was, you know, my own actions in this or previous lives. So, you know, in those situations, we can either get angry, we can get depressed, or we can transform the whole situation into the path to enlightenment by saying, this is due to my own negative karma. Okay, I'm not going to blame anybody else. And I'm going to learn from this mistake and make the very firm intention not to injure anybody else's body ever, ever again. You know? Because if I don't like this result, then I've got to stop creating the cause. Because if I go out and injure others' bodies again, I'm just going to create more cause for more of the suffering, and I'm experiencing it and I don't like it. Okay, so I've got to get my act together and start changing my habits and doing things. So you form that very strong intention not to harm others again. And then you also do the taking and giving meditation, taking on the suffering of all those who have serious ailments and whose bodies are racked by pains and by injuries. And you can think of, you know, people in Iraq, you know, both the Iraqis and the Americans and the troops from all the other countries. Everybody's just this victim of that whole karmic mess there. You know, or you can think of people in hospitals. You know, it doesn't matter whether you like the people or don't like them. Just think of those people who are suffering from physical ailments and injuries right now, and develop a courageous mind that says, I want to take on their suffering, you know, and then do this visualization, take it on and use it to smash at our own self-centeredness, and then, you know, radiate out our kindness and our generosity to them. You know, sending the medicines and doctors and comfortable beds to lay on and things like this. Okay. Now you might say, well, what's the use of visualizing all of that? That doesn't help anybody. Okay. But the thing is, by doing this visualization, it increases our love and compassion, you know, so that when we actually meet situations in which we can be a benefit, we don't hesitate to be a benefit. Okay? Because, you know, sometimes we encounter situations where we really could help, and our mind says, no, I don't want to. You know, it's too uncomfortable, or it's too much hardship, or, you know, it's too inconvenient, and we have so much resistance to helping. But when we, you know, practice, you know, with this meditation, giving our body possessions and positive potential, we're working with the mind that is so resistant, so that then when we do meet a situation in which we can give, we automatically go and help. We're not encumbered by all those thoughts that think, oh no, I don't really want to do this. Yeah. And you know, that is very important to kind of really cultivate that kind of love and compassion, because so automatically the self-centeredness can arise when there's a chance to do the smallest little thing for somebody, and then the self-centeredness arises. And there was one story, this is much to my own shame, but it illustrates the point very well. I was in, where was I? Knoxville, Tennessee, and I had been teaching about from the Lojong text on the five forces during life and at the time of death. So, you know, talking a lot about bodhicitta and so on and so forth. So I gave this whole weekend teaching on bodhicitta and the five forces. And then I got on the plane to go back to Seattle. And, you know, okay, from Knoxville to Chicago was fine. Then Chicago to Seattle, you know, which is a 4-hour flight or some 4.5 hours. I get on the plane and I specifically asked for an aisle seat, and the plane is full and somebody is sitting in my seat. And I just said politely to the lady, excuse me, you know, you're sitting in my seat. And you know, and she showed me her stub, and I said, yours is the next one, the middle seat, you know. And she said, oh, I'd really like to, you know, sit on the aisle seat. It's more comfortable. And I said, well, I would too. And this is after I had finished a whole weekend teaching on bodhicitta. You know? You know, couldn't even give up the happiness, you know, of an aisle seat for 4.5 hours to somebody else. And so I instantly realized what I had done. I felt so ashamed. And I said, okay, let's just share, you know. We'll just share, you know, doing half and half. And she said, no, 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 it's okay, it's okay. And she moved to the other seat. And I felt so rotten. Yeah.
Yeah. So the point is that the purpose of doing this kind of meditation is to undo that kind of habit so that when we meet with the situation, it just doesn't come up and, you know, make a mess.